You're listening to the Ink and Paint Folk podcast, a look at animation through the women and non-binary folk who make it. I'm your host, Cassie Soliday.
This is part two of my chat with Fernanda, so if you haven't listened to part one, pause now and go back to take a listen. Still here? Great. Here's part two.
So going back to Raise the Bar, you've learned how to write for TV and develop a series. Can you talk about like how you went out and pitched it?
Yeah. Okay. So I didn't have any idea what pitching was, what development mean, like anything of like that, because nobody taught that in college. So, and it was thanks to a workshop made by Chile Monos, this festival, that I learned that you could like sell ideas by pitching. You know, like, it wasn't necessary for the thing to be ready. You could like make a Bible and get people excited about your idea before you make it, which is essentially pitching. And so like Chile Monos brought like an American consultant. Her name was Leah Hoyer, I think. She was like a development, I don't remember if producer or executive at Disney. And she taught us how to pitch, how to structure a Bible and everything. And that time I made a pitch about here's the plan when the film wasn't ready yet. And I won a prize and everything. And she told me like, oh, you're good at pitching. And for me, that I was so shy and I was awful at public speaking, like it was like, oh, I didn't knew that was a possibility for me. So when we started working on Raise the Bar, I took all of that we learned, and we started putting a Bible together. And we meant to send it to Pixelado, which is a festival in Mexico that has a pitching contest called Ideatun. But sadly, we couldn't meet the deadline. But Chile Monos was around the corner, and there was like a market, which is very small, but still like people from executives from the channels, the Latin American channels, come and look at projects. So like Disney Latin America, Cartoon Network Latin America, Nickelodeon Latin America, not the American executives. So I said, okay, like, let's just put together what we have. At the time, it was like a synopsis, character descriptions, and a basic idea of the series, which was like a teenage Chilean weightlifter wants to become an Olympic gold medalist. And with that idea, we took it to this little market and we pitched it to everyone, and it had really good reception. And everyone gave us ideas and things to improve on. So we fixed all those problems and made another Bible. And then we took that Bible to Annecy and we did the same thing. We gathered more feedback. I remember that it was very difficult to find meetings in Annecy, because it's difficult to get meetings in markets with executives if you don't know anyone. Like the platforms they have, the systems they have, usually people, like important people, don't check those. So, or like, I don't know, maybe they saw my profile and it was like random girl from Chile, like I'm not going to give her a meeting. So I remember like it was very difficult to get meetings with executives in Annecy. But I met with Jorge Gutierrez. He bought us lunch, like my husband and I, and we pitched the series to him, and he gave us like the best feedback. And it was like, when you pitch the series, you have to tell why this story is personal to you and why are you telling this story. And so with that in mind, we reworked the pitch again. I remember my goal at Annecy was to get a meeting with Netflix, and there was no way to contact them. But then I got the opportunity to go to Pixelable in Mexico, and even if I wasn't selected in their contest, I was able to get like a business pass to get access to executives. So, and Pixelable was the complete opposite of MIFA. And the way I explain it is a little bit self-deprecating, but basically it's much easier to get meetings with executives in Pixelable because you're only competing with other Latin American studios and not with like European studios, Asian studios, American studios, like in Annecy or Kidscreen or Midcom. So I took the project, and one of the festival organizers did me a favor to introduce me to the Netflix executive and set up a meeting. But it was like at the end of the week. And the first few days of the festival, I pitched the project around, got feedback. I will go back to the hotel room every night and make changes to the presentation based on the feedback. So by the time I got the meeting with Netflix, the pitch was finally very solid. And I was able to address a lot of the notes that everyone else will say. So I could anticipate to a lot of problems or questions. So I pitched the series to Netflix, to this Netflix executive. And he said, "This is great." And I was like, "Okay, but do you have any problems with it?" Because like everyone else had problems with it, because the protagonist is a girl, and it's a little bit, the series is a little bit older. It's for 12 to 14 years old. And like everyone believes that girls age up from animation at that age, so they won't be interested in this. And every character is from Latin America. They're all Latinos. And we have a lot of LGBT characters. Like, do you have any problems with that? And he was like, "No, that's perfect." I was like, "Okay, so what do we do?" And he was like, "Oh, send the materials and we'll see." A lot of months passed until I actually sold the series, but that was the first step.
Wow. It's... Yeah. I love how you used each meeting as like practice for the next, even though you always go into it hoping that it's not just practice, obviously, but ultimately it's such a positive way to take every meeting you get, you know, so it doesn't go in your mind as a waste of time. Like, no meeting is a waste of time.
Yeah, definitely. And with pitching, like, there's no other way to get better. I think I guess there's manuals for pitching, there's general guidelines, but it's something that you definitely need to learn by doing. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're not from the US industry, I think it's information that it's much more difficult to get than, for example, how to animate or how to use this software. Like, it's much difficult to get the information.
Yeah. So you did sell this project and develop it with Netflix. And I think most studios typically have up to like 50 projects in their development pipeline, and it can take years to go through the process, with the results being few getting to actually get greenlit into production. So can you talk about how you bounced back after the disappointment of Raise the Bar not moving forward?
I think that in my head, I knew that. Like, I knew there was a very slim possibility of the show getting made. I knew that development could take years and that there was a very little chance of it getting greenlit. But the problem was that everyone made it seem that we were so close. But to be honest, without getting into much details, the development process was so messy that by the end of it, it wasn't the series I wanted to make. So when it finally ended, I was very relieved. I was like almost happy that they took that decision and it wasn't me, because at some point I thought I will have to say that I don't want to keep developing this thing because it doesn't seem like my vision anymore. And I'm glad that I didn't have to take that decision. So they made that decision for me. So when it ended, it was a huge relief and I felt like I could finally focus on other things. But at the same time, like, they killed the project, and 2 days later, I was looking for an agent on Twitter, a literary agent on Twitter, because I was like, okay, whatever, I'm going to turn this into a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. I was just in time to not sell the rights. I still own the rights.
Oh, thank goodness. That's great. That was going to be my next question.
Yeah. And also not only the rights, but also like the whole, since we had such a developed Bible by when we were pitching it, all the designs, most of the plots, all the character descriptions were mine, because Netflix only owns what was developed with them. So I think I was very lucky to have those materials and be able to pitch it later as a graphic novel. And mm-hmm. a couple of months after, I got an agent, and a couple of months after that, we were able to sell the book. So it wasn't, I kept myself busy to not mourn the process too much. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. It's going to be a book. I can't wait to read it. Like, so overall, like, what is your biggest takeaway from this experience?
I learned a lot, but it wasn't what I thought I was going to learn. Like, I thought, oh, I'm going to learn how to make an animated series. I'm going to learn more about drawing or animation or storyboarding or whatever. But since what we mostly did was writing, I learned a lot about writing, and I learned a lot about writing thanks to the fact that we work with a co-writer, like an American screenwriter that co-wrote everything with us, the Bible and the scripts. She was Laura Shrivney. She worked on She-Ra. And she was amazing, so we were able to learn a lot from her. And also we had a great producer, Karina Schultz, Brazilian producer. And she is also a writer, so we also learned a lot about development and writing with her. But mostly I think I learned about, like, Hollywood politics. I don't know, like, it was a completely different world and something that you can't learn about in books.
There are things that you can get a hint of in books, but until you're in it, like, it's hard to explain. So I totally agree with that.
Yeah. It's not in the animation books, but it is a little bit in the screenwriting books. Mm. Like, I don't know. I think I read, like, later screenwriting books that it was like having breakfast with sharks or something like that. that talk about, like, how Hollywood works. And so that was a great learning experience.
That's great. So, like, moving forward, you created your own studio, Frick Studio, and you're continuing to develop series ideas and, like, IRL Squad. Like, can you talk about this new phase of your career?
Yeah, sure. Well, actually, the funny thing is that I established the studio after making Here's the Plan. I thought, oh, after making Here's the Plan, it's going to be a success, so I need a studio for all the job offers I'm going to get. Mm-hmm. And of course it didn't happen. I mean, I did get a couple, so I can't complain. But we've been always been like a very little boutique studio, like my husband and I and whoever needs to be hired for the current projects. And so the funny thing is that with IRL Squad, when we were pitching Raise the Bar, I also, after Pixel Level, I went to Kid Screen, pitched it around, trying to find a manager. And I was able to get a manager. And he said, okay, I'm going to sign you up. Like, let's schedule some meetings in LA, like come to LA and we'll get you general meetings and stuff. And I was like, what's a general meeting? I had no idea. Like, I thought it was literally a meeting where you talk about general stuff about your career. I didn't yeah. understand it was like a meeting to pitch yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And nobody explained to me, but I was very confused because I was like, so do I pitch Raise the Bar in those meetings? And he was like, no, these are general meetings. Don't pitch Raise the Bar. Because we hadn't sell it to Netflix yet. And I told him, but I really want to sell Raise the Bar. And he was like, well, you're probably not going to sell Raise the Bar because it doesn't obey to any market needs. So if you want to sell something, you have to create another project, and this time make it a 6-11 action comedy, episodic, not serialized, and like so it's easier to sell. No, I'm not interested in making a 6-11. Like I don't like creating stuff just for like, oh yeah, this is going to be great for the market or whatever. But I started thinking about stuff that could fit that age group, and I started thinking about my childhood, and I started thinking, oh, I was obsessed with video games. Maybe I can create a series about girls that are obsessed with video games. And that's how that series was born. So it was funny because we started creating it even before selling Raise the Bar. And we won a government grant that gave us a little bit of money, enough to do the whole development process on our own. So making a trailer that now you can watch on YouTube, making a Bible, writing the outlines of the whole first season, writing a pilot script. And we developed all those materials in like 6 months while we were developing Raise the Bar with Netflix. So it was very interesting to see the contrast between both methods. Like,
mm-hmm.
like with the government grant, nobody will give us notes. We will do anything we wanted. But on the downside, we didn't knew if what we were making was good or not, if a channel was going to be interested or not. Mm-hmm. And in the other hand, with the Netflix process, it was very slow, but it was good to have like direct input from the channel and understanding what they wanted or what they didn't want. So it was very interesting to live both things at the same time. And now we're making new stuff. Well, like with IRL Squad, we pitched it everywhere and they passed. So it's funny because like we got like a really great audience reaction. Everyone in the comments was like, where can I watch this? When is it coming out? Like, and stuff like that. And I was like, no, it's dead. Like,
oh no, that's so depressing. So there's not gonna, you guys couldn't try to get a grant to make it like a short series and doable?
Yeah, no, I'm joking. Like, there's always possibilities, and like we could apply for a government grant to make it a series with Chilean money, and like maybe get co-productions with Latin America or like Europe. but I'm putting it on hold for a little while. So it was just like being like overly dramatic on the internet by saying like, no, it's dead, like it's not going to happen. It's just so people stop
stop mentioning it. Yeah.
So then I can, like, maybe in 5 years when the thing is ready, I can be like, hey, remember this? Like, we actually made it.
Yeah. It's so dark.
Sorry. But, like,
No, it's okay.
I am a little jaded now.
Oh, I bet. And ultimately, like, you do what you want to do, you know what I mean? So, like, you have this plan and you're going for things and you have multiple projects. So if you as a creator want to put something aside for a while, you can. I was just asking.
Yeah. No, but I think it's liberating because before I was a little, I mean, not naive, but I was lucky that every project that I will envision will get made, even if with national funding and everything. So now... we are making new things. We are developing new series. We won another grant. We're making new trailers. One of them is a stop motion series. A stop motion trailer for a new series idea. Another one is a 2D adult animation series. And like now there's a bunch of stuff and they have different possibilities. Like if the stop motion thing doesn't work out as a series, it could be a short film. If we don't sell the adult series, it's in a style simple enough that we could make it with our own money. Like we're trying to be flexible about how to make things a reality, because before we thought, oh, the only way to make something is to sell it to a network. But yeah, I'm a little bit more realistic now, I think, after the Netflix experience. But I'm still hopeful that we can make new things. And probably even with IRL Squad, we could rewrite it as a feature film or as a limited series. We could age up the characters. Like there's a lot we can do to revive the project.
Mm-hmm. So like a perk of being part of an existing corporation is that there's a system in place for employees, like insurance and benefits, hopefully. But like you're heading your own business and it all lands on you and your husband's shoulders. So like how do you personally cope with the stress and in order to keep moving forward?
Well, we are very privileged in the sense that we don't have children, so we only have to feed ourselves and our cats, and we work with freelancers, so we don't have to we're not responsible of maintaining an actual studio running. But I think that's why we haven't chosen to grow up more, like expand as a studio, because this way we can maintain it flexible. We are not taking like commission stuff, like we're not making commercials or service. We're just since we are making the book, we are writing and drawing the graphic novel, the Raise the Bar graphic novel. We're putting all of our time in that, and also making these little trailers with a team of like 4 or 5 people. So I think that the fact that we have been able to keep it flexible and change plans as things come along, that's what makes it less stressful. And also like I'm lucky because I've been lucky to work with people abroad while living in Chile. So the money, the money goes a longer way here. How do you say that?
You can make the money stretch a little longer.
Yeah. You can stretch out the money by living here, because it's so much cheaper than than living in LA. And we lived in LA. We lived in LA where we were taking some classes for like 3 months. And it was so expensive. And before that trip, I was like, oh, I want to live in LA. But now that we're back, I really appreciate that living here gives us the freedom to maybe do these more independent projects, in contrast that maybe living in LA and having to work for a studio or taking a lot of commercial projects in order to survive. And health insurance is much cheaper here than over there, so I can get my own health insurance and it's okay.
That's so great. Yeah, because I mean, I only know here and all the premiums are so high in rent. So I was curious about that.
Yeah.
So we're going to wrap things up. But first, let's celebrate others. Who is one of your favorite fictional characters and why?
I think it might be Pearl from Steven Universe. I think it's a very well-constructed character. And her design is very appealing. And also the protagonist from Whisper of the Heart, which is my favorite movie, my favorite Ghibli movie, because I don't remember her name, but it changed my life to see that movie a lot of years ago, because it was one of the first time I would see a girl protagonist in a movie being so driven to complete something. And in the movie, this girl wants to write a novel, like her first novel. So it was like, oh my God, this movie is so grounded and we want to make the same thing. So I felt very like identified by the character.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah.
Who is one of your favorite creators? Can be any medium, writer, artist, etc.
One of my favorite directors in terms of, well, of course, Miyazaki, like he has influenced me a lot over the years, but considering him as a person, like I don't strive to be him anymore. Like I used to fantasize like, oh yeah, I'm going to be as tough as Miyazaki, but then you watch the documentaries about him and he's very bad to his crew, so I definitely don't want to do that. But for example, I do admire a lot Ava DuVernay, who is a live action director. Ava DuVernay, yeah. Mm-hmm. And she's a great director. She directed Selma, and her activism and the way she inspired minorities to pursue their dreams. Like, I think that's amazing. And for the longest time, I will watch her interviews to inspire myself to keep going. And also in animation, Jorge Gutierrez, of course, he has helped us a lot during the years. He has been sort of a mentor for me. And his work is amazing, Book of Life, and his future series is going to be amazing as well. And Elizabeth Ido, who made City of Ghosts, was premiered recently. And she's great, and I'm very lucky to know her in person, and the fact that she creates such a special work is something that really inspires me, because I feel like I also make work that is outside the what's usual in animation, so mm-hmm. I know how hard it is to do that, so I admire her a lot for that.
Katya and I interviewed her for the podcast because, like, I have a huge wish list of people that I want to interview. And you and her have been on it for a long time, but she actually was like, you should reach out to Fernanda. She'd be great. And we were like, okay, we will. Because it always helps. I get so shy reaching out to people I don't know, because I usually just interview people that are in my network of people I've met. I felt like this was reach out to you. I was like, I hope she says yes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah, but she thinks so highly of you.
Then it's mutual. Yeah, that's great.
So, who are you digging right now that we should check out? Just promote other folks, friends or coworkers or people you just admire from afar.
Yeah, I will encourage everyone to watch Elizabeth, City of Ghosts, because I'm obsessed with it. I I was able to see one of the first animatic she made back in Netflix, and so I had been waiting for it for a long time, like years. So when it finally came out, I watched it in one sitting, and I've been watching it again and again, because and every time like picking up different details. And I usually don't watch anything twice, but like really, this show is so good.
Definitely. You know, I just thought of a question that I probably should have asked earlier, but I'll ask it now. Kind of like when you were talking about loving the heroine of Whisper of the Heart, like, and connect with her because she wanted to make a book. And, like, you've made a book, and the film you made, Trazos, as well. Like, do you tend to put your life in the stories you love and create, in the ones you create as well?
I will say it's a weakness and a strength at the same time. It's hard for me to work on something, to write something, if I'm not putting myself in it. And that's what drives me to create. You know, animation is so hard to make. Comics is so hard to make. So I really need like a really strong connection to the material to actually make it. And I think the difficult thing about that is that it's difficult to measure if you are deciding on plot points and taking decisions because you're creating a good story because it serves the structure and the entertainment of it, or if it's because it serves like your feelings. So finding that balance between telling what you want to tell thematically, but at the same time make it a coherent, entertaining story, is a difficult balance to make when you're putting like all your feelings into the stories, you know?
Yeah, totally. A lot of my work is autobio too, so I definitely feel that it's a strength, but it's also maybe a weakness too. But that's such good advice for the balance of it.
Yeah, and it makes you so vulnerable.
Yeah, because if someone really doesn't like it, then it's like a little piece of you and it hurts.
But it's high risk but high reward, I think, because then when people come to tell you like, oh, I felt so connected to it and I really identified with it, then it's like it feels amazing. So I think that makes it worth it.
Yeah, for sure. So, final question. Final advice to our listeners, like it can be anything about creating your life, whatever you want to leave us with.
I think that the best advice I could give is that the sooner you realize that you don't need anything to start, the better. Because honestly, like you really don't need anything to make something. And I think that way, because, well, coming from Chile, that there's so few resources and the budgets are little and everything, I used to be very bitter about it. And I was like, oh, I can't do anything with this budget, or like, oh, no, like how am I going to make great stuff with like we don't know anything here. Like I didn't went to CalArts or whatever, like. And that kind of thinking can really drag you down. So I think it's important to not think about what you're lacking. Like, oh no, I don't have this. I don't have a Cintiq. I don't have a good computer. I don't have like a camera or whatever. Like, it's better to start thinking, okay, what do you have? Do I have a old cell phone and paper and pens? Well, then you can start making comics. And if you want to eventually make a TV series, well, you can maybe start making comics of that idea. You want to make like a feature film. Okay, maybe you can make a short film on your own, like a 1-minute short film. And that's something, and that will bring you places. So just don't think what you're lacking, and just think what do you have to work with, and make something with that.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That is great advice. And you are proof that you can do it. Where can people find you online?
Yeah, it's just Fernanda Freak everywhere. I have my studio website is ffreakstudio.com. And yeah, I'm on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I feel like I don't know anyone who does TikTok videos. I'll have to check that out for sure. And everywhere else.
I'm already too old for TikTok. But there's a great art community, and it makes your work easier to be seen. Like, it reaches a lot more people than Instagram, for example. And it's been fun.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been amazing. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for the invitation. I usually don't have opportunities to talk in English. I hope that my accent wasn't too bad. I hope that you guys can understand it.
It was great. I can understand you perfectly.
The Ink and Paint Folk podcast is produced in partnership with Women in Animation, an organization dedicated to advancing women in the field of animation and reaching 50-50 by year 2025. Learn more at womeninanimation.org. Please also check out other great organizations and groups promoting diversity in the industry. Black and Animated, Rise Up Animation, Latinx in Animation, Asian Queens in Animation, and Diverse Tunes. This episode was produced by me, with the magic of the internet from beautiful Burbank, California. Music by Grace Tsai and TV's Kyle. Edited by Mae Murphy. All opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast. Stay colorful.